Self-aware millennial. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another wonderful episode of The Self-Aware Millennial. I am your host, J-Mix. It's August, which means we are in the home stretch of New Orleans' brutally humid summer. I am crossing my fingers that we don't have to deal with any hurricanes this year, but you know, it's 2020, and let's just say this has been the year of all years, so I can't honestly predict anything, and I'm just going to let history and nature run its course. At this point in time, the best thing I could be right now is prepared. So that's what I'm going to do. Anyway, you guys, this is going to be a chill, mostly unscripted episode with not much of an outline due to the fact that this past week I've been tired and exhausted once more, and I have no energy to contribute to a big conversation about something that just drains me. I'm channeling energy to still give y'all some good content for this week's episode, but I'm taking a different approach by bringing on two of my trusted friends to discuss their experiences as Black Americans in the NOLA Theater. I've been having many moments this past week where I'm just starting to realize that I need to be around and talking to people that get it and not exerting all of my energy on those that don't. Because my healing comes with being around people that get it. Get it? So that's what this week is dedicated towards, healing. And I hope that you will enjoy this episode as we talk about just some healing properties that need to happen in New Orleans and in the community of Black folks all around the country. We will be joined by Lauren Turner and Cameron Ware, and I will save their actual spiels about who they are for the actual broadcast. I hope that you enjoy our conversation.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lauren Turner, and I am a Black woman theater maker rooted in New Orleans, Louisiana. Also the founding producing artistic director of No Dream Deferred, which is a community anchored theater company here in New Orleans.
Yes, she is. She's all that and more. Hi, everyone. I'm Cameron Mitchell Ware. I hate this part. I am a Black cis man rooted in New Orleans, but living in Brooklyn most of the time, some of the time. I am primarily a performer, but I've been spending the past, 2 to 3 years working as a creative director and creative consultant to a couple of different organizations across the country and with a couple of different artists and companies. And I am super stoked to be here and talk to Jessica because this is, and Lauren, this conversation about her is a long time coming.
Is it? To kind of get into it, I wanted to know first off how both of y'all are feeling right now.
I feel a little bit how I've felt since kind of the beginning of all this. And I don't mean 400 years ago, I mean like March, which feels like 400 years ago. So I've kind of always held a small pocket of like what I call Black man Aquarian detachment, where like there's part of me that is completely shut off to the tomfoolery and a little bit detached from the tomfoolery, very like what one of my heroes, Anna Deavere Smith, talks about, you know, being within and without. So like, there's a part of me that is very happy to be outside of the world and to take on the role of an observer because it keeps me emotionally safe. Mm-hmm. But there's also a part of me that is always a little bit enraged. I mean it's kind of like a vacillating thing. So I kind of go in and out of that. But mm-hmm. Now, in like the past couple of weeks or so, I've kind of started walking this, what I find beautiful middle ground of like, being able to hold the weight of both of those spaces and still kind of press forward and not be so freaked out about what future might be, but know that there's a reason that I'm waking up and there's a reason for me to put energy into still building something, and that feels right.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned waking up because, yes, I also, the timeline for this time period for me began in March, when New Orleans was essentially shut down And I remember at the time, I was feeling a lot of like spiritual urging to just rest. And it felt very like antithetical to what I thought I should be doing at the time and what everyone else was doing, because I felt like everyone in my network was activating. And yeah. It was just an overwhelming urging to rest. And I actually got a reading because my birthday was in April. So I got a reading for my birthday. Shout out to Mama Sula Spirit. And she was like, yeah, just get into the habit of telling people no, rest up, sharpen your tool, because we don't know how long this is going to last. But when it's over, you need to be prepared to fight.
Ooh-wee.
And I said, oh, shit. Because this was like in April. So I was like,
yeah.
We're fighting. Who I'm fighting?
Wow.
And that time, I really took that to heart. And I did. And I rested in all forms of just, I mean like ridiculously indulgent rest. Rest I haven't had probably in maybe 5 years. I mean, there were days in the beginning of this where I was like in the bed for 2 days.
Yeah.
Like just straight up resting. Yeah. You understand?
Yeah.
And I feel like now I'm starting to come, I'm waking up not just from, you know, just up, but like I'm also waking up with so much insight as to real great insight around what the fight actually will be. Ooh. And I think that if I would have like been my old self and activated immediately, I would have burned through a lot of energy fighting and doing things that weren't, that had nothing to do with really what the fight is.
Come on.
And yes. I'm just happy to be in a space now where I have real good clarity. Like when I speak to when people say, what should happen next? Or what are you hoping? I know exactly what that is now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. My goodness. I appreciate the fact that, and I've told this to a lot of folks lately, that what's happening right now with the quarantine is just the idea that we all finally get a chance, or at least most of us, I'm not going to say all of us, because there are some of us that have not had this time to rest and can't really like come to their senses. But I was very much like Lauren, where I had a chance to sleep finally. In the longest time, like the type of sleep where like I would wake up at like 6-5 a.m. and just decide, oh, I think I'm gonna go up on a bike ride right now because I can and I'm not tired. And like, it's just little stuff like that, like healing properties that I am never able to exhibit ever because I'm always working so much. So, and bike riding and just like exercise for me is one of those things. So being able to do
and like
it.
And like what Cameron's talking about too, just like the rest in all forms in deciding to be an observer. You know, if your go-to is like, I'm engaged, I'm an activist and I'm engaged all the time, rest could look like choosing not to do that. You know what I mean? And like not to, at a time when I think everything around us was basically, you know, begging Black people to be outraged and traumatized, choosing not to be any of those things.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm going to go ride a bike right now.
Totally. And both of you have said it so beautifully, too, that something that has stuck with me, it's a personal journey. It's a personal expression. It's a deeply personal reaction, you know, in this time. Like, just like Blackness isn't a monolith, the way we get to respond to trauma and our pain and process all of that shouldn't feel monolithic or small, short-sighted either, right? It's not.
There is no right or wrong way to deal with this.
Well, yeah.
Everyone does it differently.
We inhabit so many different identities. I mean, like, my rest looks completely different from Lauren's rest, or maybe even your rest, Jessica, but especially Lauren's rest. I'm not a Black mother out in the streets. Like, I don't have babies. So your rest, you know, like, deservedly so, should be 2 days in bed. I don't have to carry the mantle. So, like, that's some real, real stuff. We want to talk about frontliners. Hello. You know.
How do you think, at the least in this moment, that you're taking the time and energy to heal and rejuvenate? Now that we are how many months into COVID-19 craziness? is it?
Six.
We're six, 6 months.
Going into seven. Well, half the year is gone.
Wait, oh, really?
Totally. Yeah, it's like.
Wait, that was March, right? March, April, May, June, July, August. Oh my gosh.
It's August 1st.
Yeah. Wow. Almost half a year. Or just about.
And what's so crazy is that it's not like we're nearing the end of this journey. Like, people are already talking about how, like, count things like Mardi Gras out. You know, that's February. You know what I mean? Of 21. So we're talking about going into the next year kind of in the same.
I didn't even think about that. I don't know. For some reason, I'm still thinking, like, this just happened. Like, this just started. But I think it's just my perception of time and just my reality right now. It's so different than it has been for the last couple of years. So it's just like, this summer has flown. I've been telling people. I'm just like, I can't believe we're almost in fall when this all started in the spring. It's definitely a unique time. I was also talking about how 2020 itself is a unique time. I'm thinking about just what happened at the beginning of the year from the parade incidents here in New Orleans with, people getting rolled over and killed. And just that whole, like, that was, I think that's almost where it really started. I could be wrong, but, like, that was, like, the first big incident where I was like, this...
The juju is off.
What? Yeah.
No, but in so many ways, you're absolutely correct. Because when they actually went back and looked at everything, that's exactly where COVID-19 started, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, with all that was going on, the virus was spreading all throughout Mardi Gras. So, like, and literally, that is when it all started. It was at the top of the year.
Yeah. So, my goodness.
It's not a little bit before. That's, for me, that's when, like, outbreaks started to get bad or symptoms started to flare up. I mean, those people have been in town internationally at least through the end of January, some of them, you know, or top of February or something like that, or coming in and out in that way with our new airport and all.
I mean, in so many ways, I feel like that we called this in. I mean, all of the requests, you know, for 2020 vision, I think we're getting exactly that. I mean, if we don't have a clear picture around what's wrong with this country, where we stand as people, what's wrong with our systems, how we're broken, you know what I mean? Like, we're getting it. It's not just maybe not in the way that we thought we would, but.
Right.
Totally.
I mean, and I'm also taking into account like, Kobe Bryant's death and how sudden that was. Like, that COVID-19, the uprising again of the Black Lives Matter movement, that never really went away, but it just kind of dwindled because of, you know, X, Y, and Z reasons. And then we still got the election coming up.
Or do we? Because this fool is playing games. See them slow down the mail?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I heard about that. He's taking away TikTok. He's taking away TikTok.
Taking away TikTok. He don't want y'all TikTokers messing nothing up for him.
Oh, Lordy. I'm telling you, like, thinking about everything that has led up to, like, just now and, like, what we have done as people to prepare for something like this. Obviously, you know, as we said earlier, we're all doing it in our own way, but I think some people may be more prepared than others because of circumstances. So with that in mind, I think, because we are all three beautiful Black persons of color, I want to go into just a little bit more about our experiences in predominantly white institutions. Actually, the first thing I should ask, because I asked this to the Tulane kids, were y'all... fortunate enough to grow up in an environment that was not a predominantly white institution for your education?
For me, no. Yeah, I think that's kind of in some ways, I mean, you know this, Jessica, and I'm sure you know this, Lauren, too. Before there were charter school systems, I mean, like, my parents always make this joke, kind of like our house joke, where, like, it's terrible, but it's like if you wanted to learn how to read when I was coming up in New Orleans, you sent your kid to a private school.
Yeah.
But and like, but like at the time, you know, the school board was so bad, that was what it was. So I've only ever been to religious PWI schools, you know what I'm saying? Except for like maybe 3 years in the middle where I went to St. Rita over off of Carrollton, right across from Dominican.
Oh, I didn't know you went to St. Rita?
No. Oh, yeah, I went to St. Rita, pre-K and then first grade, and then I went to that Lutheran school on Canal Street by the Walgreens, St. John Lutheran. I went there from second to sixth grade, and then I went back to St. Rita for 2 years, eighth grade. Then I went to Jesuit, and then I went to a Jesuit college. So sprinklings of an experience, because St. Rita was quite black.
Yes.
But in terms of like, you know, so like at good years, I always call them, I got the culture and the experience that I wanted and needed. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I've only been educated in those types of institutions, for sure.
Mm. How about you, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. So growing up, I went to predominantly white schools. What I'm realizing now is I always had like an uncommon experience of having a lot of black teachers, and the student bodies were diverse.
Gotcha.
There was quite a amount of diversity, but as far as the school, like historically, the schools were predominantly white, and the leadership was definitely white. And it wasn't until I chose an HBCU for undergrad that I got like that black experience of like everybody black except for like one or two white folk.
Yeah. That sounds wonderful. Can you go a little bit more into your experience at a predominantly HBCU? Because I just want to live. I like to live through other people's stories.
Same, please.
You know, it's crazy because I went to school at a time when HBCUs were not popular. Actually, it was like, don't go, like your guidance counselor was like, don't go to an HBCU, go to the white state school, right? Because, and then the reasoning would be, you know, well, the world isn't like that. So, you know, you want to be prepared to be able to work with white folk. And my whole thing was like, look, I will never in this country have an opportunity like this again. I'm going to grab it. Like, when do we have the opportunity to be around us
in America,
right? Taught by us, like in the community with us, it just, you know, why would I not grab that for now and go to the white school later? You know what I'm saying? I got a whole life of white people. I'm dealing with white people. Like, give me my 4 years.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? And so going there was like, I mean, I honestly don't even know who I would be without going to HBCU. I received so much context about who I am as a black woman that my friends who went to those predominantly white state schools, they still are, they got it or they're getting there, but it was way later. It wasn't like when I was saying it, they were looking at me like, oh my God, you know what I mean? And then I would say probably, honestly, I can pinpoint the moment when people started asking me again about my experience was right around Trayvon Martin. And a lot of my friends who had bought into the hype of you go to the white school and you do, you know, you do this and you do that, were like, fuck this shit.
Yeah.
And I wish I would have went to an HBCU and I would, you know what I mean? So it was everything. I mean, it was the best.
Yeah, my sister, she went to she went to Xavier. So I kind of vicariously lived through her a little bit, even though I was young, but I was just like, I could do this. Like, this is cool. Like, I like these people. They're like, they like me, you know? And actually, funnily enough, I met Cameron through that. I met Cameron through Xavier.
Like, this is my dad's student.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out to North Carolina Central University.
A-A-O. Yes. Come on, Eagles.
Yes, we fly high.
No, yeah, that's so beautiful. I share the same thing, that jealousy of not having gone to an HBCU. My HBCU opportunity was Xavier, you know, but I am, first of all, Xavier, and we can talk about like how HBCUs run by like predominantly white organizations because I do want to say organizations because Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament technically run Xavier, just like they run Xavier Prep. And that is obviously a meant to be a predominantly, correct me if I'm wrong, meant to be a predominantly BIPOC, like, not urban space, but like, order, right?
Yeah.
Right? They're meant to be, they're meant to be Black sisters in that way.
Yeah.
Which the last couple of years might say differently, but that's not because we're there. But by the time that I was about to go to college, I had been to Xavier every day after school since I was like four. So I got to live vicariously through your sister and your sister's 4 years and the 4 years of kids before them and them living in my house over the summer and my mom getting them a job at the AMP on magazine before it was Bromart and them getting money from my dad and driving here. Like I literally, I'm not saying Sadie, like my your sister and all those generations of people who are now teachers at Xavier or teachers or performers in the world kind of came through my house. So I had that, what I would call a different world experience.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about right there. Yeah. You know? A different world experience.
Yeah. But like to my earlier point about Sister of the Blessed Sacrament running an HBCU, I didn't go to Xavier, not because by that time I was just burnt out, but because they didn't have theater. There was
There was
no arts besides music.
Music.
With my dad. And I wasn't about to be a music major and have Dr. Ware be my no.
It so was like, too close to home for you.
Too close.
Yeah.
You know, so more than
our theater department was started by Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh wow.
All right.
I know. So that was like, and that's another thing I love about HBCUs is all that little tidbit of history that just feels so like you could reach out and touch it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, she was like in between jobs. And she, this is why I love her. I love Sora. But she was in between jobs and like snagged this, was asked to like start up this theater department in Durham, North Carolina. At the time, I think it was like the North Carolina School for Negro Teachers or something like that. And she did, and was out. Like, she was like, peace, academia, after like 2 years. But yeah.
That's amazing.
Can't say I blame her.
Yeah.
I know.
Lauren did actually answer this question, but I feel as though, and I was telling the Tulane kids this earlier, the only Black instructor teacher I had throughout my entire career in education, like from preschool to senior year of college, was my band director in like my in fourth grade. And he wasn't even like, I mean, he's a teacher, but like he was like a band teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking to myself, like, I didn't really get a chance to think about that. Like, but like all the other people that have taught me were either white men or women, mostly white women. And I was like, I still like think about it. I'm just like, how? I don't, it was definitely not anything I really thought about until recently. And I'm always like, just kind of looking back and I'm like, how did that affect me overall? Obviously it's affecting me now because I'm realizing it, but like, how was it affecting me when I didn't realize it? You know? So I guess I was wondering if y'all had any, if you don't have any, to let me know, but also if you have any Black instructors, teachers that you had the privilege of, you know, being taught by, I would love to hear about it. Oh, you know what? There is one other person, but again, this person was not a teacher, was not an instructor, but it was the guiding counselor at my high school. Her last name was Miss Ladmerault. But, you know, I remember always going to her as like almost like a safe space because I used to just go in there like she was a guidance counselor. But like we would just talk about all kinds of stuff. And I always enjoyed my time there. It felt like I was talking to my own mom, you know, just like it just felt like, especially at my high school, predominantly white, like pretty much all white, St. Mary's Dominican High School. Going in there and like,
what you laughing at, Cameron? Me?
Hey, yeah, I'm laughing at your face.
It's just always like over here, like, oh my god,
yeah, but it was like those, god, like Jesus. Those spaces that like I crave for, realizing that that is something I'm missing. It's like realizing that you've been thirsty this whole time, and then when you finally get a chance of like a little sip of water that you've been missing out on for god knows how many years, it's like, well, where's the rest of it, you know? So,
Look, I'm just glad you're here. Because, that is, so many little landmines to navigate.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. like...
But this is just an education standpoint. Like, I had the resources. I mean, I had my family. I also had my church members, which I was at the church every, like, every week. So it was like every, you know, I had that time, a sense of community, like, within my own, like, Black community. And they were wholesome people, very, I mean, they are. What am I saying? They not, I'm speaking in past tense, like, they're not still these people. But they're, you know, it's definitely an outlet that I could, you know, something that I look forward to because I was able to be around my own and, like, you know, everyone already kind of, again, kind of like how I facilitated this conversation, I needed a space where I don't have to, again, explain myself, where people just kind of get it. So do y'all have any Black instructors that, like, really set the bar for you, or just set, even if it's like the lowest of the low because it's the only one, but, like, do y'all have any that you would say that, you know, you kind of, you know, are impactful in your education?
Yeah, I do directly. I, as per usual, kind of owe everything great in my life to a Black woman. Seventh grade, I was back at St. Rita, mm-hmm. right across from Dominican, right across from the Archdiocese, right across from that big church. And for the first time, I had a Black teacher. Her name was Deidre P. Reed, and she was everything. And she was not only my seventh grade teacher, and was the first time that I felt like, talk about conditioning and what having mostly white women up to that point do for me. What it did for me was, is that I thought that that was the academic standard, right? That that was how teaching went, that that was how my Little House on the Prairie moment went, that white women taught Black children, and that that is how, in a weird way, that was a big, big moment of unconditioning in the seventh grade where I was like, whoa, there's this completely different energy. This first time that I ever felt like the teacher was not just proud of my scores or almost fetishizing my excellence, but was actually proud of me and the background that I came from when I did well in her class. But the best part about Deidre P. Reed, aside from her beautiful, beautiful braid fascinators, the first time I'd ever seen a teacher have different hair every week, and I said, oh, this is where it's at. This is amazing. This is amazing. You better pull that slick back into a plaid bun on the side, Miss Reed.
But yeah, we bring the styles now.
Sure,
we
do. Never,
Black women will bring some styles up into the professional setting.
Yeah,
come on. She brought her Sunday to the Monday, Tuesday, and I was here for it.
Oh my goodness.
My biggest point was that Miss Reed was also the speech and debate teacher.
Okay.
And
ooh.
Introduced yes. to oratory. And that was the first time that I went to, like, St. Aug and 35 and won trophies for, like, oratory and speech and debate and being given monologues. And she put me on this platform and was like, you have the, she, like, saw me and put me in this space at my little school in seventh grade. And I had my world. Oh, I didn't want to do anything else. It didn't matter if at recess they were calling me Fruity or whatever. I was reading a book from Miss Reed's thing. I was getting a new monologue from Miss Reed. I was performing for her. I was asking her what she thought. You know, I was letting her know that I wanted to be involved in this thing. And she submitted my artwork and, a poem that I wrote on MLK to this book. And that got published. And I got to do a speech at the House of Blues and speak it for this MLK festival in seventh grade. Like, she changed my world, my
yes.
entire life.
See, that's what Black teachers have done for me and continue to do, because, I was explaining this to someone else, all of my Black teachers, Ms. Wilder in the third grade, Mr. Brown in the second grade, all the way up through college, are invested in my whole development.
Yeah.
They're invested in a way that white teachers are not invested, because they're invested because I'm their community member. We have an interconnectedness and an interdependency that's like, when you do well, we do well. So, you know, and their job doesn't stop. I mean, back when I was growing up, you know, you would see your teachers at church. So yeah, like, your teacher would be in school, you know, they would be big on pronunciation, right? And like speech and being clear. But that's also because they also were in charge of the Easter play. And during the Easter play, they also had those same expectations. Mm-hmm. I remember my mother used to get so mad because in my early childhood, I had Black teachers who were, and I thought they were crazy. I still kind of think they're crazy. I mean, Miss Wilder used to have this thing about erasing, where she had lessons on teaching us how to erase. And it was like, I don't want to see any like leftover marks. And I was like, this lady is crazy. But it was like, she was teaching us using a simple skill, excellence.
Yeah.
Excellent. And when you do something, yes, you do it well. Ain't no half-stepping. You know what I'm saying?
If anything matters, then everything matters. Yes.
Right. And that's what she was teaching us. And then when I got my first white teacher in fourth grade, I remember this like it was yesterday. This lady had this conversation with me because I had got my first C. And I said, I must have been on my face that like I got this C, right? And she was like, Lauren, a C is great. It's fine. It's fine. Mm. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, this white woman is amazing. And she's making me feel so good. And I like come home to my mom and I'm like, Mrs. Fang said that the C is fine. It's fine. And she was like, she's saying it's fine for you. She's like, it's not fine. And yes, I will never forget that because I was just like, I felt so comforted by this white woman, not even realizing that she had a different standard for me than she had for the other white students.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I was meeting her standard, her expectation for me as a person who can get a C. I was meeting it. And she could not even see in the same way that Miss Wilder and Miss Brown could see that I am capable of so much more. She couldn't even see that.
She was more than happy for you to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I had that moment in college too, but more recently, in like the past, like what, 2 years or so, mostly because of this research that I've been doing for the show and just really being fed up with you know, just energetically around trying to find different expressions of Blackness that most specifically predate me. I'm a 90s kid, I was born in 91, but just like where, like, like for instance, I was talking to my dad the other day, and then I get to a major point. It tripped me out. Talk about Clarence Thomas wanting to be like for the Supreme Court. It tripped me out when I learned right before I was born about the Anita Brown case, and they let him on anyway. Like they don't teach you that in school. I didn't know that he had that drama. I didn't know that he was positioned in that way on that board, and that he's all. I had no idea that this Black woman put herself in such a vulnerable position. Do you know what I'm saying? So like when things
and are- that he and the narrative he used to defend himself was that he was being lynched.
Exactly. Can you imagine? So like I just looking back at things that predated 1991 or were right around that time, I rediscovered, but discovered in a deep way, my Good Sister Soldier and that 360 Degrees of Power album. If you've never heard it, get into it. There's a lot of, I mean, she's an amazing rapper, but I forget which song it is, but there's something that she says very plainly, very matter of fact, that has stayed with me for like the past 2 years and made me look at education specifically in this way. Uh-huh. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. White people will never teach Black kids how to win because Black kids have to compete with white kids and white people want their kids to win.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
And that's raw and that's a stark generalization, but it really made me think. It really made me start to understand, you know, how I was viewed in these systems, in these PWIs of education and academia up to that point, and why my parents, a professor, a manager of X, Y, and Z, demanded my A's and B's and nothing less. It wasn't just for my goats and my dots.
Right.
It was to prove that I wasn't the one token kid in the school that wasn't about to be okay with a C in your fifth grade.
Exactly. And it's sad, but I mean, that's kind of how we get to our accolades that we have now is because we have to be so much more than our white counterparts, especially in these predominantly white
institutions. That's what I was going to say. I feel like that culture of excellence, like I was just talking to somebody about this too, especially for Black women, I was raised in a way where excellence was the expectation and I was surrounded by women performing at an excellent level, like across the board. And maybe it's excellence that's like, you know, the aesthetic of it is very much so like 1980s style, you know, women in the workplace with the shoulder pads, like that's the aesthetic, but that's also a mentality. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking about the ways that has been harmful for me too. like, especially now, and talking about trying to get more rest. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's not that level of excellence consistently does not compute with also tuning into my needs to take care of myself at all. But it was necessary. It was a survival tactic for them. It's not sustainable.
Goodness.
And I look at that generation of Black women now, and I'm like, you know, they're suffering physically. You know what I mean? They're suffering physically from high blood pressure, hypertension, anxiety, depression, something wrong with their muscles. They can't, you know, they're, you know, and I'm just like, how much of this has to do with that way of living that you have to constantly be performing at this excellent level all the time?
Yep. Yeah.
That is precisely, every time anyone talks about Black women of that nature, I think about my own mom and my grandma who just passed last year. Like, but mostly my grandma who just passed, because like her entire life, she was that person, like just striving for excellence, doing everything that she could in order to make sure that her children and grandchildren had everything that they needed. And I'm just like, you know, it infuriates me only because I know that she probably could have been on this earth just a little while longer had she not have had to use all of that energy and that exhaustion on that in a world that wasn't going to assist her in any of that, or, you know, they don't want to see her succeed in that manner. So like it infuriates me just in that regard. But
because you can't win that race, really. You can't, because it's like excellence as compared to what, and it's like to white standards. So white framework, I am performing excellently, you know, in this white context.
Yeah.
And you never can really beat the game. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, and then like, you know, Black women especially will pass on this mindset to their daughters as what they think is the key to survival. You know, we're going to raise you up to have this same way of, you know, whatever. Almost like passing poison down. You know what I'm saying? Just like passing poison down generation after generation. Like, I think I want to raise free Black children. And so I want to encourage them to create their own ideas of what success and excellence looks like. And then also let them know that they're so free that they can fuck up. Like white kids can fuck up. White kids can fuck up.
Yeah.
Until they're not even what we consider kids anymore. Because, you know, Black folk, we kick our children out at 17, 18. You know, we got 30, 38-year-old white folk who are still children to their parents who are fucking up. You know what I'm saying? And they can.
Yeah.
Come on.
Our kids can.
I love how we're talking about this, because I think this will kind of maybe go into what I initially wanted y'all to come on here and discuss with me about. We're all theater makers, as we know, and we've all been at least involved in the New Orleans theater of some sort within the last couple of years. There has recently been a living document for BIPOC experiences that has surfaced for any person of color or Black Indigenous person of color to contribute to. I will leave the link in my show notes for you guys to check it out, but it's been out for, I would say it's publicly been out for a little, about like a week or so. I've known about it for a few weeks beforehand because the administrators or the moderators had reached out to me to see if I wanted to contribute at that time. But at that point, I was dealing with a lot. I was even like, I think that was during my little self-care break too. So I was just like, I just don't want to use that energy at the moment. But after what happened a week ago with Summer Lyric and that email, you guys, let me give them a little rundown right quick. So Tulane Summer Lyric Theater is probably, would it be considered like one of the oldest like theaters here in New Orleans?
I think they probably have the second oldest.
The second oldest.
To Le Petit, probably.
Le Petit's definitely the oldest. Yeah, you're right. Tulane Summer Lyric basically currently is run by another director as of recent years. His name's Michael McKelvey. And this past summer, because all of the shows were basically canceled. This is like a summer stock theater, by the way. It's only in the summer, and then throughout the year there is the Tulane, like the Tulane students actually have like a theater program, but Tulane Summer Lyric is only in the summer. I've done it a couple of years in the past. I've starred in their shows. I've been ensemble and everything. I think I've been working with them since 2010. But they recently... Actually, you know what? Let me backtrack a little bit. So when all this was happening, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, this was all happening at the same time that Summer Lyric was going to be doing a live stream of like performances by different, you know, different people that have worked through the company, right? And the BIPOC community took it upon themselves to make sure that Summer Lyric at least stated something about, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement at that moment. We had a handful of us that assisted the artistic director in the statement, and it was posted, or I should say it was it premiered on the actual live streaming. He even stated like Black Lives Matter, we got to do better in X, Y, and Z. And then a month later come around with the gala streaming that they were going to stream, which was like the first thing that they had done since this live streaming of the performances. There was absolutely no BIPOC folks that were going to be in this streaming that they were going to stream. I think it would have been in the next couple of days or so. And basically all hell broke loose in the BIPOC community because we were all like, this is bullshit. And you literally just said Black Lives Matter, yet the people that you are showcasing in this upcoming 50th anniversary gala, which happened like 3 years ago, they were just going to be restreaming it, you know, just to make up for lost time, since I believe one of the excuses was that not many people had a chance to see it anyway. But I was like, there are other ways, especially since you are trying to move forward, like you are literally taking steps back by doing this. So I don't even know how I got on Tulane Summer Lyric's case at the moment, because like,
You were saying because how that was the impetus for you to actually want to contribute to the Living Doctor.
Right, because I was fumed. I was fumed up, right? I was fumed. And funnily enough, it wasn't like just because of Tulane, because I really have not, thankfully, I guess I should say in my experience with Tulane, most of my roles with Tulane have been like roles that Black women would do already. Like I was in Big River and I played like one of the ensemble members. I'm pretty sure we were like, I don't know if we were slaves or what. Like that's sad. I don't remember. Like I just remember like I was with a choir of Black people, and I was like, cool. And then also I mean, actually, Cameron, I think didn't you do Hairspray with me at Summer Lyric?
Yeah, that's the only Summer Lyric show I've ever done. Yeah.
And I mean, that was, again, that was like maybe the fifth or sixth time I had done Hairspray. You know, it's like always utilizing and wanting us for the same roles. I don't know how many times I've been a Dynamite in Hairspray.
Are you saying that New Orleans theater recycles the same old shows over and over and over again because of a lack of originality or innovation about how to program their seasons?
I also think it was very interesting because, like, that same year, I think there was two other theaters that had done Hairspray at the same time. Like, it was always at the same time.
Like, the time where Cripple Creek Theater had done Ragtime a year before, and then the very next year, Summer Lyric Theater did Ragtime.
Yeah.
But Michael McKelvey asked me, you know, because I had, you know, nothing to do with the first Ragtime. He asked me if I would, or no, rather, he asked me to audition and asked if I would accept anything other than Cole House. After I had already, quote unquote, won the Big Easy. So you want me to go from this to ensemble to what, fill out numbers?
Right.
Ostensibly, he said yes. And I said, you're a fool. So that's my only history with Summer Lyric Theater. And I know this person that we're talking about very well, but we'll get to that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that was where everything fumed for me. And other things were just kind of coming up, and I think I maybe have mentioned, I definitely mentioned this on my Patreon, but I'll share this with everybody. at least within my experiences at the World War II Museum, there have been many that I just have not really come out and said, but I did put in a document. And I don't know if I want to go completely into it at the moment, unless y'all want me to. Actually, I should ask, have y'all seen the document? Have y'all had a chance to like read through what they put in there so far?
Oh, sure.
I try to read every morning with my cup of coffee. For update.
And I don't know how much they are updating it, but like now that I know it's there, like I just kind of check every.
Oh, it's
twice a day.
More. Every time I've looked, sadly, horrifyingly, there are more and more testimonials.
Hey, self-aware friends, wanted to come here quickly and let y'all know about my exclusive community on Patreon. For as low as $5 a month, you will have access to bonus content, including Patreon exclusive episodes, behind the scenes footage of my self-aware livelihood in all its glory and all its gory. And you also have first dibs creative influence on the planning of my future episodes. If you are ahead of the game and caught up on all the episodes that I have posted so far, consider joining TSAM Patreon community so that you can get your fix of TSAM more than once a week. Thanks for tuning into this Patreon blurb, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show. You know, like, people think that it's just the predominantly white theaters that are having this issue, but someone did post something about Anthony Bean.
I saw that.
Yeah. And definitely what he had said to this actor, Anthony Bean himself, had said it was very discriminatory. So this is also, like, I mean, this is definitely more of a predominantly white theater problem, but I'm also basically saying that this is not, it's not just for them. Like, other theaters that aren't predominantly white are just.
I mean, because you're talking also about systems, you know what I'm saying? So I said this, like, I told this story, India will probably kill me because I keep telling this story, but like, India was like, you know, I know we're not going to be up there. And I said, we don't know that we're not going to be up there because we are built similarly to other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so white supremacy isn't one person. It's not like, oh, this artistic director is a racist. It is literally the foundation on which these institutions are built. So if you look, if your organization looks anything like any other organization in American regional theater, you have the potential to cause harm to someone. It's going to happen, whether it's around race, ability, sex, all kinds of things. It's going to happen. And I really feel like what sets different spaces apart is how they count ability to when they fuck up.
Yes.
Like, how do you handle when you fuck up? And like I was saying this too, one of the things I noticed in the Living Doc is that it's not like this person did this to me and now I'm putting it in this document. Most of the testimonials are like, this person harmed me. I confronted them about it. They did nothing, or they gaslit me, or they retaliated against me. And so now I'm putting this shit in the Living Doc.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's not that you fucked up. It's that when someone called you out on it, you continue to fuck up.
That's true. What about you, Cameron?
I mean, I have a lot of questions, and I have a lot of feelings, and I have a lot of what I know will probably sound like criticisms.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that first and foremost, it might have to do with like me not having as much knowledge and information as I could have. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that first.
Okay.
Cameron.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's real. Like, I want to say that first. Like, it's a really complex issue, not just for me, but for everyone. But it's complex for me because I spent a lot of my time in the Living Document rereading the first two or three pages of it, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, shout out to Jessica. I know Jessica Lozano very well. Shout out to all of the anonymous contributors and the facilitators of this Living Document. Like, I think the work is beautiful and necessary and on time. Like that goes without saying, I hope. What I'm curious about, what I have wonderings about is like the framing of the document and its purpose. What I might even be a little bit critical about is the rollout of the document and the optics of how it's been received and the optics around how this document's intentions were supposed to influence the community at large or the community at minor, right? Like, I have not been following so much of the updates around why it was specifically in one space and then made public. I know a little bit about it.
From what I've heard, and I could be wrong, but they had it kind of, you know, hidden for a while so that BIPOC folks could, you know, contribute to it. And I think it was around the time where, you know, Summer Lear released their email, and I believe somebody went in there. Because at first...
Yeah, somebody went in and tried to wipe...
They tried to,
to change it. There was a testimonial against them, and they tried to go in and actually edit the comment.
Yeah.
How is that possible if it wasn't public?
Well, okay, it wasn't public. Like, it hadn't been posted online anywhere, but it was still public if you had the link. Like, anyone could go in and edit it.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about the framing of it all. And I sound critical, I know, but I'm going to own that space. It's as I read it and I wonder about audience and about intentionality and around, like, if this document was meant to offer a space of healing or a space of, like, galvanized storytelling, I love that. I appreciate all of that. But for me, there should have been a framework in place so that only, and there is an even breakdown of this too, right? It's on the document. There's like a place for BIPOC artists in New Orleans to respond. There's a place for BIPOC audience members to respond. There's a place for white whomever to respond. For me, that net is a little bit too wide, right? So if we have a space of healing and galvanized storytelling, right? Like, for me, anybody who had the link at the very beginning, for me, should have been a BIPOC artist in New Orleans, point blank, period. Because we're the ones that understand each other's stories, and we're the ones that can not so much corroborate facts or storytelling, but we're the ones that can organize in that way and then start to have an understanding of what the demands are like. When we start to add too many cooks and things get too spiced for the pepper, or there's just or if things are created out of reaction, a reactionary thing, we have to take that accountability on ourselves to kind of like figure out what our hand in all of that has been and why there's this for me a failing of the system in place that's supposed to be supporting this document. There's, for me, it feels like community is using this document in a way that it wasn't intended to. And I feel like the news cycle effect of that will be detrimental to the community and its original dreamed of intentions. That's just my instinct. And so from that space, I am critical.
It's okay.
I think that we need to welcome all critical thought into conversations in order to kind of like clarify our position, honestly, on things.
Yeah.
I would say that I have some of the same questions as Cameron. But then I started to dig deeper into this idea of testimonial, right?
Yeah.
And so in thinking about what is a testimonial, like in church, right? It's like, it's something that a person that's deeply personal, that a person speaks to in a public way and is not really in control of who hears it.
Yeah.
But it is their truth that they are given space to speak out into to the masses. And what then also like thinking about what that does for that person, and then what happens to the person who hears the testimonial. The idea is that people who are hearing the testimonial begin to believe in what that person has experienced, or are bearing witness to something that has happened to someone. But like also thinking like, is there action required of the person who bears witness to the testimonial? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, these are the questions that I have in it being framed as a testimonial.
Yeah.
I too feel like, because of where my opinion of where we are as, and also I want to push back too on this idea that BIPOC folk are pressing institutions right now. You were speaking specifically about Summer Lyric.
Yeah.
And I want to say it's really Black folk. And
that's
I want
true.
To be clear about that. You know what I'm saying? As much as possible, because I think people we got BIPOC now as a term, but we still need to, you know, remain clear on who's doing what. Yeah. And it's Black folk.
It's Black folk.
And, like, I want it to be clear, because when we push for these things and we make it better for all BIPOC, I want people to understand
who of the BIPOC is doing it.
Right. And specifically, it's a lot of Black women right now, too.
Yes.
Always put that front and center.
Yes.
But, like, when I, too, feel like where we are as Black theater makers in the city is that we need, and this is coming from my own personal experience. When I had my situation at Southern Rep, it was, I had to search. I mean, I want to thank, you know, Cameron was right there. I didn't have to explain anything or prove anything. And there were other folk, but by large numbers of the people that I talked to, Black folks, they gaslit the shit out of me.
Come on.
Shit out of me.
So come on.
For me, seeing this document and knowing that other Black folk in the community were seeing this document, I was like, gaslight this. This is other BIPOC folk, Black folk saying these things are happening to me, and you can't just sweep this under the rug. Oh, it's just you, or that never happened to me. Or I don't think she's really like that, or I've never had that experience. I'm not getting paid 50% less than the white folk. You know, and it was like all of this, to me, the document was like, maybe this can be a mirror and like click some people into place. I even saw people commenting, other Black performers saying, I never realized how racist New Orleans theater was until I read these testimonials. And, you know, I'm screaming from the top of my lungs, like, how?
Right.
How do you not see this? But, you know, also being like, well, maybe this is what it took for people to understand and see. And then they're like, oh, and then now that I think about it, I was asked to be a monkey in Tarzan. And it's like, and you didn't even consider that to be a race issue until you saw this testimonial.
Right.
There was a thing online where, like, some white women were already, you know, to speak to what Cameron's talking about, were already trying to tone police and set the rules for how this document should look and be rolled out.
Really?
And yeah. I'm gonna be honest, it was triggering as fuck.
Yeah.
And they were saying, oh, there's people whose names are being named who don't have consent and all these other things, which, you know, I'm just gonna go ahead and state this. I believe consent is very important in every situation.
It is.
Yep. So I'm not negating that, but do not bring your white woman politic to this fucking document as a way to distract us from talking about the real shit that we can never talk about.
Yes. Yes.
Fuck out of here. And I told and I remember I messaged Jessica and I was just like, what is going on? Are white folk going to be dictating how this document is managed and what is being said? And are they looking at this through a gaze of verifying how true it is?
That's what I'm saying.
They're almost trying to make it all out to the, you know, so that they can eventually be a part of this document or this conversation when it was never intended for them anyway.
And I love what you're saying, Lauren, if I can, about testifying. Yeah, totally. I mean, the sharing of one's truth in public space has always been about the freedom for it. Yes, the victim or the freedom for the oppressed, sure, or the marginalized person. But I also feel like if we talk about law and testifying there, for me, it testifying in terms of how this document is set up kind of goes back to where testifying really comes from. And if we want to talk about it, we can talk about it, right? Like back in ancient Grecian times, right? Like a man would literally bare himself and another person would hold his testes. And in order for this person to speak out into the space so that we would know that this person was telling the truth. Otherwise, he was in danger of being harmed or hurt, right? Even in that setting, right?
Oh, I love that.
But to borrow that idea of being heard by a mass that was meant to respect the oration of truth or respect truth in the space, there is an assumption of justice there that I think is lost when this document has been shared. There's an assumption of the audience being prepared to and equipped to respond and handle in a way that we would deem appropriate and a way to start discourse. That shit ain't about to happen, right? I made a post about
it's not gonna happen, number one, because all of these spaces are perfectly aware of the ways in which they have harmed BIPOC folks.
Yes.
So this ain't no new news. This ain't no new news.
Mm-mm. And that's what I mean. Nobody. So it has. It really is at this point, after all this shit in 2020, it is about an individual and in some ways, if they're capable, a collective moral pivot of heart that has to happen on the part of the inhabitants of these PWI spaces from leadership all the way down. And that's going to take time. So for me, it's about let them do that and Google and ask us to be on their advisory boards. And we can choose to do so if we have the time, energy, and space. But let me remove a lot of that energy and focus on how what I personally in the New Orleans community have been. You notice I only pick and choose what I'm in.
Yeah.
Let's be real about it.
Same.
That started happening 5 years ago. For me, to speak to my Black people in this community, my fellow Black artists that I've been around as a Native in that way, is about kind of like that Baldwin quote. Our crowns have already been bought and paid for. We have to put them on, right? We have to understand, we have to accept. Like, I get the energy of, well, this might be the only chance I get to do theater this year. Cool. But you also have to remove so there's an accountability on both sides to me.
You have to be prepared to not
risk for them. Risk something.
Yeah.
Risk something.
Yes. Something.
And listen, I know it's as deep as all of that conditioning to us still being a part of a larger conversation about the intersections of patriarchy and white supremacy and capitalism in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I get that. But there has to be, for us, a bravery and a separation. Like, I know I sound more Farrakhan than Martin, but that's on purpose.
I think you're very Martin, because Martin spoke to a collective thinking, which is completely lacking. And like, this is the thing that I just have been grappling with for probably the past 4 years. I told y'all, I think we were on another call and I was like, you know, referencing Tanya Pinkin's essay about this. And I was just like, you know, when J-Pass did fucking West Side Story and Brownface, there should not have been another Black person that auditioned for another show.
The fact that we still keep
bringing our asses to these spaces that are harming us is doing us such a huge disservice.
Yeah.
We are teaching them how to treat us.
Yeah. But the issue is like, and I think this is also what I mentioned on that call. I said, like, some of these people don't even know, because they're coming in and they got, like, you know, they're white people that work for J-Pass that know that they don't know us, like people that have already been through their institution. So they're just bringing them in because they're like, hey, you know, like using it almost as like a new opportunity for them that they would have not known otherwise, you know?
And I know there are people like that. I know that. But I'm going to tell you from my own personal experience, I know that there are also people who I have told explicitly about the harms perpetuated at Southern Rep, and not just with me, but in throughout their pay inequities and other things that were happening, who have looked me dead in my eye and said that they're going to continue to engage with this harmful space. And do to this day.
Yeah.
Or other spaces. Other spaces where testimonials, sans a living doc, have been brought forth that people have intimate knowledge around, and they continue to engage. So I think collective thinking can seem really big to people and impossible, especially when, you know, of course we're not a monolith, you know, we're not. So I'm like, what are you going to do on an individual basis? That's all I can, you know, really pose to people, is like, what's your line in the sand? And right now, I feel like people are actually drawing their own personal lines in the sand a lot more, but that's easy to do when no one's producing.
Uh-huh. Ooh. 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 Oh, hey. Ooh. What?
So what's going to happen when they start producing again?
Come on.
Are we going to go run over there to J-Pass to be in the Wiz for the 5th/11th time?
I said this, keep your Black ass at home. And let's be real. My good friend Grandma Fun and I were talking about this on Facebook the other day, as I recently returned to Facebook. It's like, What does all of this get, quote unquote, us anyway?
Yeah. Nothing at all.
I'm not trying to pit like city against city. I'm not trying to talk about like that age old conversation of New Orleans theater doesn't have a stake. New Orleans theater absolutely has a stake. NPN conference is held here. The CAC, when it was more than what it is now, was absolutely a champion and a bastion for like having international conversations around work coming through this space. Lauren, you're a product of some of that echelon as well, right? Coming into New Orleans and offering all of your knowledge from TCG. Do you know what I'm saying? But like to that end, Black people here have to look at when has JPass ever launched the next blank, blank, blank to whatever? When is JPass? Yeah. And Dennis Lasoff used to sit at my living room table and eat dinner. My dad and him are conductor friends. Like, but I know these people before bankruptcy and after. Zoop. So all I have is stealing from your own family, and that's how they do. So my point is, if we know all this stuff already, when do we actually, like you're saying, take that pacifier of survivor or savior from these people and actually start to have different conversations with each other?
Well, we can't until we start to deal with internalized white supremacy, because a lot of this has to do, and we talked about this too, proximity to whiteness.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter if you believe the lie. You believe the closer you are to white, the more professional, the more right it is, the better it is. And it doesn't even matter that you're getting paid 50% less or that it's not really a stepping stone to anything else.
Because you're just so thankful for the opportunity to be around all of this quote unquote excellence, these resources.
You drunk the exceptionalism Kool-Aid. You know, I'm the only Black that works here.
So they'll know my name.
Yeah, I've been chosen because I am versatile. I've got something that these other Black performers don't have. Let me tell you something. You ain't got nothing.
No.
That the talent in New Orleans does not have. And it's racism keeping people out of these spaces.
Yeah.
You ain't special.
And also not for nothing. I mean, I'm guilty. I hear that. And I have to say, and hope I don't sound elitist in this way, but I'm guilty of it too. I was talking to... but in a different way, and I'll tell you how. I was talking to the theater person of the year just this morning, and you know him.
We know him.
And we were talking about like what these spaces in a different way have done for us, for you, Jessica, for people that have maybe been moving and swimming in this pool for a while. Like, I did the Petites Youth Conservatory last year for the first time ever. Don Scott, Max, I never got any support from the top up. They even hired Cammie West as a curriculum builder, and I never saw her once until she came to Midsummer Night's Dream at Le Petit. They hired her in case I was shit. My point is, I positioned myself coming back from New York to be like, you don't have this program in place. Max, you have no idea how this goes. Don Scott, you really just want to hit on me and see what I'll do with your space. I benefited from what I needed to in terms of like paying my rent that month, being able to go back to New York, you know what I'm saying? So like I have positioned myself to benefit from the way it is or the way it was in CWI spaces. So there is a grappling there too where I have to, sorry. And the last thing that I'll say, I was also critical of the theater person of the year's contribution to Two-Length Summer Lyric for Give Nola Day. And we talked about that, what that meant when there are plenty of other organizations, Black-owned, Black-run, that probably could have benefited from that money. I didn't want any part of it. So we have to talk about where we actually still put this shit into our own faces.
And putting that into perspective, and I think we're all, I know I'm guilty of that too, of having to align in the past with predominantly white spaces for funding, but we have to understand that we are able to do that. Like, what has happened that Le Petit has the ability to fund you in a way that perhaps Junebug may or may not be able to. And what has happened is literally the stealing of federal fund. Well, I won't say federal funding for Le Petit, but the domination of space and resource in a way that is not equitable or fair. Mm-mm. So that's why they can do that.
Yeah.
You know, and same thing with Southern Rep. I mean, Southern Rep was my first education on how disgusting the commandeering and stealing of federal funding can be.
Yeah.
You know, there was, you know, so much money came in for projects that were centering community and equity and inclusion and diversity that were used to fund whole seasons of Caucasity. And then when it came time to actually roll out those programs or those shows, there's no budget.
Mm-mm.
There's no budget.
No
for
budget left for that. For the
because you spent the $50,000 on fucking A Doll's House Part 2, which could have included Black folk because the Broadway version included Black folk, but you chose to make it all white.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the lead teaching artist of your youth education corporation is getting paid less than $500 for 6 months of work and then thereby effectively had to quit right after you. Wasn't that right, Lauren?
That was right. And I'm the face of having to give that person that.
That was
I'm being made to be the person who has to then underpay community.
And that was a part of our relationship. And I, to be candid, you know that I was taking that gig to build relationships with you.
Right. Which is what that position had crumbled down to. That was a part of my realization was like, oh, I'm being asked to leverage relationship in a way that nobody else in this organization is.
Yes. Yeah. And she knew that.
All for the benefit of an organization that could give two shits.
She knew that.
And if those relationships are damaged, collateral. It's collateral. Who cares? You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, the harms, that's why I say the living document and everyone's on their own journey of realization.
Yeah.
But like the thing that just, I just get so crazy about is the fact that if community had a full awareness of the way in which we are harmed in totality, not just as far as it relates to casting, you know what I'm saying? And I know for actors, that is the thing. That's it, right? But it's, and please, I'm in the most respectful way I can say this, it's so much, it goes so much deeper than casting.
Yep.
You know what I mean? The fact that there are theaters, and like this idea that like, oh, theater makes no money, bullshit. There are people in our community, in our theater community, who have made livings for years, salary.
Yeah.
Salary.
It's about where are your priorities in your budget?
Yes.
Yep.
But that's also my thing about putting your crown on and kind of realizing your space and time. Again, I know I sound like an asshole, but it's like
whatever.
Not to me. But I mean, I know what you mean because I'm the same way.
Well, listen, let me tell you something. Thank y'all like for being strong in that for me, because I'm going to be real. I always get nervous talking about like New Orleans stuff in space simply because of like maybe how some of these white kids have built me up, or even I'm going to be real, how some of these white kids have like spoken about me specifically in spaces that maybe put some black people against who they think I am, because I don't give a lot away. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always, I never really voiced that.
Yeah.
So but what I have to say about all of that is like, in terms of like putting your crown back on, you have to know who you're working with too. You have to care about who you're working with too from the front. You have to educate yourself about all this stuff. I mean, I'm guilty of it too. I've been program manager for this company in Brooklyn, for a year now, and had been introduced to the kind of like that sector of nonprofit work, kind of a little bit on the front end. I worked at CAC for like 10 years, but not in that way. But Lauren, to your exact point, you're exactly right. Right? Like, just because now all this is happening, suddenly, I'll steal the term, BIPOC people in New Orleans are like, who's your leaders? Who's your board? You weren't worried about that when you were taking that $300.
That $300.
That's what I'm saying. That's why this Tanya Pinkins essay goes so hard, because it was like, miss me, black people. You want to come out with a list of grievances? What did you do in the room
right.
when Southern Rep was doing? I won't even keep using them. When you were a monkey in Tarzan, and all the other black folk were monkeys. Where was the outrage?
That's
right.
3 months of work.
3 months of work for what? $300.
Don't come around 2 years later wanting to put it in a dock and want to yell at yell at all the white folk for accountability. Where was your accountability?
Right.
Right. And all my point is about that is that, again, not to vilify victims. I'm not saying that, right? What I'm saying is that, like, and not to kind of truncate Jessica's and all of those people's contribution. But what I'm talking about is sometimes in the looking at the kind of small window of conversation that we have in New Orleans, the kind of zeitgeist that we have, I likened it to a cookout with my manager over in Brooklyn. I was like, the world has these windows of a cookout moment where you can be the person that brings the dish that gets the plate to go home, or you can be the person that brings the dish and it's still got foil on it at the end of the day. Who are you? How are you showing up to the cookout in this moment? So right now we have a very loud voice, a very reactionary living document that, for me, just because there's a loud voice, it doesn't mean that that's one that needs to be listened to, because there have been organizations and people that have been doing this anti-racism, pro-Black, anti-supremacy work in this city for a while that could have been reached out to, that could have been asked for a contribution or used as a resource in so many different ways, instead of something that feels like a reaction because we're mad at white people. For me, that's...
Well, I don't think it was a reaction. I think that... I know that Jessica looked up, because the document actually began in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? So I don't think that it was like, I don't get the sense that it was like knee jerk. I think that it wasn't thought through in terms, there's not full thought formed in terms of how to utilize it and how to protect it. And I think that it's not too late for that to be determined.
No,
not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. All I'm trying to say is that I'm having a hard time landing myself somewhere comfortably when we have these conversations because of what we're talking about on the front end about a lack of outrage or everyone having a stake in benefiting from how it was. And then now how we handle the visceral and deserved reaction to this document now, given the uprising that's happened. Yeah. Right. So it's like, how do we as BIPOC people hold accountability first, for me, like I kept saying at the beginning, to each other internally, galvanize around that so that we have demands outwardly facing that feel like they're united, as opposed to now having to address so-and-so adjusting so-and-so's story or so-and-so weighing in on this testimony. So I have a hard time seeing how we're going to come out of this as a community.
The intention behind, I think what you're trying to basically say is like, what is the intent behind the doc in itself? Like, what sort of change?
What are the goals?
What are the goals of the
document? How do we not get distracted by white folks' reaction to the document instead of focusing on like, how are we utilizing these testimonials to move us forward?
Exactly.
Instead of having to spend so much time worried about like, so-and-so tried to edit this person's man, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, because that is irrelevant.
And also, I want to say this too, and this may be a little controversial, but like, it comes down to us, Black actors in this city. If you are at all connected to the theater community, I don't want to hear you say, this is why I stay in film. And do nothing. And that's why things won't change, because there is a lack of community. Or this is, you know, it's bad over there. You know, this is why I do film.
Yeah.
And you remain silent in the face of all this shit when you are in a play. Because the people that want to say, this is why I do film, whether they don't do theater anymore or not, you can no longer use that as a justification for your silence.
Yeah. Because it's still happening, whether or not you are a part of it. I mean,
I just want to say film is just as bad.
It is.
Or worse.
Yeah.
It's not worse.
No.
Because the abuse of time on film to BIPOC people is outrageous.
So just go ahead and say that you're not about nothing.
Come on.
Just go ahead and say that you don't want to have any skin in the game. You're not about nothing, and you could care less.
I just don't see how that's possible anymore. And again, for me, it's not about like vilifying victims up to a certain point. It is about like us being at this place in history where like everybody has kind of a tabula rasa, right? To like pivot and completely reshape and reframe and reimagine and dream differently about how they move through and influence the world, especially their little microcosm of an environment, right? Like you don't have to, first, we don't know what future we're walking into. So why not do what you actually want to do? Why not actually do what you're actually called to do?
Right.
Because the systems around what the old way are literally breaking down around us by the day.
Yeah.
By the minute.
Yeah.
So what's the excuse anymore?
So, yeah, actually,
right, exactly. Yeah. There is none.
With this, I want to like just kind of discuss right quick, what should we be doing moving forward from this? Because I mean, like, yes, the doc is there, and you know, people can basically continue contributing and like making light of things that most of us have already been privy to, like basically our entire times of like being in NOLA theater or theater in general. I know in that meeting that we had earlier this week, there was talk, obviously, and I think this is where my brain is right now, and where I just want to leave all these predominantly white institutions, because in the end, like right now, I'm using all my energy to make them better, and they're just going to make more money off of it. And like in the end, it's like, it's not worth it. I'd rather create us have our own creative spaces so that we can allocate wealth within our own communities, because otherwise it's not going to be going to us.
I will say that, like, for me, and this is the part where I just get a little spiritual and ancestral. I mean, I move forward with faith and hope kind of constantly. I can't remove that from my energy. I can't remove the, like, very God is trying to tell you something, goosebumps, chills that happens when I think about what could be, you know, coming down that long road. Shug said, I hear you, Lord. So I can't kind of like uninvest myself from what feels like a perpetual struggle. So mm-hmm. I'll say that first. So there is always hope and faith in that way. I do want to say, in terms of like this window of a cookout, some of these PWIs are going to listen to a degree. And I think that some of that listening means, whether it be interim or like permanent position replacements on some levels, I think that is a positive thing. I think that like the young charismatic white girl that goes and like newly informs a position at some space who actually has a BIPOC, has sensibilities towards like BIPOC issues, could be a catalyst for some change on some instrumental level, right? Like I was having a conversation with Theater Person of the Year this morning, and we were talking about, and we were talking about specifically at that institution, Jessica. I hear you. I support your journey specifically with WW2, but as Theater Person of the Year continues to like work in that space and shape that their group that we're talking about, he was like, I was like, you want to do this? Are you sure? Like, well, we were having a real, I was like, don't. And he was like, yeah, but there's also something about the art making that can be used to challenge. There's also something about like that voice in this space, if he so chooses, which he does, it's put on that mantle, that could be about transformation. But what do we do next? We make art.
Yeah.
We build. We continue to have conversations and discussions virtually, obviously, for safety. Mm-hmm. For me, it's about talking to our resources that we've been ignoring for a while, right?
Right.
Like, there's no reason to me why Lauren's phone shouldn't be blowing up about how No Dream Deferred is going to try to look towards the future from every Black artist in town. There's no reason. We have a wonderful, established, well-named arts organization, and with a goddamn space mm-hmm. in the city. There's no reason why Lauren's Give NOLA Day should start looking at a different constituent similar lyrics from now on. There's no reason.
Right.
You know? So that's what I'm talking about. How do we reinvest? How do we defund mentally and reinvest appropriately?
Yeah.
You just have to do it. It's really quite simple to me.
You're right.
I think that ultimately we are on a journey towards justice, and I think justice looks like the seeding of space and resource by predominantly white institutions. And I think in order for us to get there, and this is a new thought, because I was more like you, Jessica, where I'm like, get out, everybody, get out.
Yeah.
Now I'm saying that we do need folks who are equipped and have assessed their own risk to be in spaces to help us see these resources.
Yeah.
Predominantly white institutions can never be anti-racist as long as they're committed to staying predominantly white.
Yes.
They can never be allied spaces.
Yep.
Yeah.
They will always be harmful. It's inherent to who they are at this point. And so ultimately they're going to have to be dismantled. I want all my people out of the building before it falls. And I want to make sure while we're in this, you know, the building's crumbling right now, these institutions are crumbling in this moment, that we are able to redirect resources and funds to our organizations and institutions as effectively as possible. I think the writing's on the wall. A lot of these leadership in these institutions know that. They know that the end of this road is going to be reparations and seating and all this stuff, because they've been stealing. They've been thieving for 50 years. So that's why they're dragging their feet on the little stuff and making it such a big deal to get a statement or such a big deal.
We're basically going into their pockets otherwise. And that's the main thing.
Yeah, it's like they're dragging their feet on the little stuff, and we're getting caught up on, well, what's your board look like? I really feel like none of that in the end is going to matter, because none of this shit can stand.
No.
I don't care if your board at your historically white institution is all black. It could look like you could do Roots the musical for the next 17 seasons, and your institution is still built on a rotten foundation, and it has to go.
And that's just the logistics around like organizing and like, and again, that nonprofit sector thing. For me as an artist first, I'm looking at the emotional thing. I made this post the other day. I love forgiving. I love freeing myself. The air up is so much pressure, but I will never forget. I don't forgive and forget. Are we really? You could change your board. You could invite me over with your best Grey Poupon and crust. Like, that's all good. But what would make me feel emotionally safe to reinvest my gifts, my time, my talents back into your organization?
Right.
Even if somehow you did have what are we looking at? What does everyone hope for the ideal world to be great in the next year? Isn't that what everyone's hoping for, that in a year will be great? Because that's what people seem to expect. Like,
yeah,
if you just
like
change,
it's gonna happen all
in the next 6 months, I'm gonna dip a toe back into your mayonnaise.
But even with the We See You document, you know, the demands, I'm like, you know, this is where my critical brain kicks into high gear. You know, they're saying we want 50%, you know, BIPOC representation on boards and productions. And I'm like, so let me get this straight.
Yeah.
We want all of the people of color, all of us, to share 50% of the pie, while white people get a whole other 50% to themselves.
Meanwhile, like, we don't even still the same size.
Right. We don't even want to actually, we're not even demanding equity, real equitable progress in our demands.
Mm-mm.
Equity would look like in New Orleans that your board looks like 67% people of color. That's what this would look like if you want to get real.
Yep.
That will never happen.
Mm-hmm. And someone knows that. Some black organization has already done that work. And that's what I mean. My boss is on that list. My mentor is on that list. I know that list. My boss put his name on that list and got to our team call the next week and was like, oh, well, that was a completely separate thing. That was David Roberts, the person, not David Roberts, head of 651. I was like, my dude, the optics of what you're trying to do as an organization, you cannot separate yourself anymore, because you're having a moment of identity crisis. We will see this name and they will associate you with this organization that you're the ED of. So this flippy floppy doesn't work. Just because We See You is the loudest and one of the most prevalent voices because of the celebrity of its rollout does not mean it's the voice we should be listening to. That's exactly what I mean. There is some
what I mean by seeding is, if we're talking true equity and we have companies in New Orleans like JPass or like you know, Summer Lyric, whoever, now saying we're going to have a 67% black board, we're going to have 67% of all of our production hires black, we're going to have, you know, a increased focus on having our audiences look more like this city. What you're creating are black theater companies.
Yeah.
And this whole city will be full of black theater companies, because guess what? That's who lives here. And so they would essentially be seeding their idea around what theater is to black folks. And that is what they are trying to avoid at all costs. And that's why they would much rather fuss with you about a statement or about, you know, hiring a black board member than getting to the real conversation about equity.
Yeah. It's true.
And that's what should make everybody angry, is that if this was an equitable situation, this city would be full of Black theaters instead of there being three.
Yeah.
With nowhere to perform.
Nowhere.
I think we need people who are committed, who have the capacity to be inside these organizations, but they need to have an analysis. We need a shared politic. And the analysis needs to be that I'm committed to speaking truth in this space and demanding the ceding of resources and space to Black folk. That's my role in this organization while I'm in it. And for those who don't have capacity like me, I don't have the capacity to be in these predominantly white spaces. My blood pressure can't take it. I can't. So for me, it's about working my hardest to find resources to build something so that people who are in these spaces feel like they have a choice. Because choice gives you so much agency. So many times people say, well, I'm in this organization because what do I do if I leave? I had a whole great coffee conversation with two sisters, a Black sister and a Puerto Rican sister who were working at Southern Rep, who were literally in tears. Like, where else do I go if I'm not where I was lucky enough to find work in my field? One sister had her master's degree. And she said, where do I go to work in my field at this level if I'm not in this space? And like, is No Dream Deferred in a position to hire people? And it broke my heart because we're not there yet. But we're not there yet because of all the disparities that exist in funding and all the other things. You know what I mean? So it's like, my job is to get us there so that y'all don't got to be in these spaces struggling and being harmed and feeling like you don't have a choice. And for folks who are there, your job is to be that siren that will not get off their neck and will not leave them alone and will constantly demand this cast needs to be mostly Black. This, have you considered doing a co-pro with Junebug where you give up space and resource and do a show together? Have you done this? Have you done that? Mm. You know what I mean? They have to be working in tandem.
I think definitely for the listeners, because yes, we're still doing a podcast. I feel like I'm just in a conversation with y'all, but this podcast is still rolling. Y'all definitely, especially right now, Lauren is like leading this whole game, not game, this whole, I don't know what you want to call it. Is it a game?
No,
it's not. That's my thought. She's leading this right now. And I know there's a lot of you guys that are supporting me now on Patreon, but like, if you got to hop off of Patreon, and I think No Dream Deferred, you said, has a Venmo?
Lauren has a Venmo, but No Dream Deferred has a donate page on our website.
Okay.
www.nodreamdeferrednola.com. Deferred is spelled DEFERRED. No shade, no shame.
Come on.
One thing I want to say, and then I'm going to be done, is that I think very logistically, I think that if we started a 67% movement, where Black artists commit next year to demanding ceding of 67% when they decide to go into production or into a space. Mm-hmm. Whether that be casting or percentage of profit that goes to Black art makers from the production, but 67%.
67.
That's what I come with. Gotcha. Or in my agreement, you have also agreed to pay me and seed space to a artist or a producer, a BIPOC artist or producer at some point, free of charge to produce something at some point. But that your body showing up in those spaces will mean that something has to be seeded from that company.
What are y'all thoughts on reparations, especially just in the theater companies right now? I know you kind of went into it, Lauren, but I'm curious, like, what would you think reparations would look like in our case as Black theater performers of color that are demanding our place in these theater companies? Because I mean, also I should also mention, I remember you were talking on Art Equity this session about the fact that, yeah, we do deserve to be in these spaces. I mean, yes, there is this large pull to like leave and just like say, you know, like, oh, well, fuck this, you know, I can't, you know, like they don't want me anyway. And, you know, let's just start our own unions. Let's start our own X, Y, and Z's. But then you have to remember, like, we do belong in these spaces too. Like,
but I wouldn't say where... belong. I said we have a right.
We have a right to be there.
We deserve much more than what these spaces offer us.
Yeah.
Way more than what they... But we have a right to be there because these are publicly funded spaces.
Right. Publicly.
That so is we the have, key word. We have a right to be there. They can't actually say that this publicly funded space is going to be predominantly white. I feel like that shouldn't even be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get... How, Sway? How do you keep off tax liability as a organization for public good and then also say we're predominantly white?
Right.
Yeah, I was going to talk about reparations. I mean, it's so tricky to me because reparations is like what? 18, 19, 20 is like a 300-year-old conversation, right? I mean, reparations has been around as a conversation for Black Americans for so long, and I don't know why. I know specifically there are some factors as to why like reparations have never actually come to be in America, but for me it's also about like looking at like again to the framework of demands for the living document, that idea of like what is it that we actually want from, is reparations literally just transactional? Is it just about Black Americans getting money? If it is, cool. If that's the conversation, I say we find that rate or that the metric for how that would be allocated and let that be a thing. And then we each have our own little quote unquote pot of wealth to do with and pour into and contribute to each other or to the world as we want to. But for me, it feels like reparations or the idea of reparations is also tied into like repaying some sort of like lost emotional energy that I don't know how to address that part of it. I don't know how like Maximilian and maybe a donkey is going to make me feel better about what it is that's happened to my ancestors. So in that way, I don't know. And I don't know how to rework that into a framework now, post-COVID, quote-unquote, post-uprising, global uprising, where money given to me from a white capitalist government, while yes, I could do much with that and change my community with that, but I also know that like we had our own money one time before and we're doing real well. And then that little thing in Tulsa happened and they weren't so happy. So I'm not saying that we're going to revisit that space, but I'm saying like the healing of the money has never really been the thing. Do you know what I'm saying? In my mind. Mm-hmm. So like past money, what is it that they could do? Michael McKelvey, give me another lead role. Let me play Bobby and Company. What do I want? What do we actually want? And I don't know. I'll say this, I would love to see New Orleans actors, specifically BIPOC artists, not the audience members and not the white quote unquote allies, be clear about what they could want from these people. Although I don't know how much leeway it would have. Like you said, Lauren, your point of like people who have the energy to be in those spaces to do that work.
But are you prepared for the heartbreak of hearing back from community that they want to be in The Wiz?
No. Am I prepared for it? Oh, sure. Yes.
I'm not.
Oh, I am. But because it comes with so many different things. That comes with experience. That comes with timing. That comes with simple stuff that has to do, and by experience, I mean travel. I mean about moving through. And I never mean to be critical about a terrible word for some about transplants in any way to any degree. But like as a New Orleans native, I am of the mind of the school of thinking that you have to leave. You have to leave and go. So if anybody here in New Orleans, forgive me, we don't have to be Instagram friends. I'm not on Instagram right now anyway. If it's about I'm not. I had to come up IG so they can't stalk me. I'm writing right now.
Ooh, Lordy, speaking of stalking, I just wanted to throw this out there just because I feel like I may not have even mentioned this, but this is my platform and I'm letting y'all know there are people actually, I'm just saying their names, I don't even care, people that don't necessarily follow me but are like literally stalking my Instagram stories right now, and that are like leadership in like these institutions that we are talking about.
I wonder why.
I don't know. One of them's Gary Rucker right now from Rivertown. He literally looked at my story the other night. No idea why, but you know, it's like times like that. I'm like, why? Like, what's the point? If you're, I know my Instagram page is public and whatnot, but also like the VP of the National World War II Museum has been checking out my Instagram. The same one that like basically told me that I could not speak to the CEO about you know, my grievances, because I guess there's been so many other people. They never really gave me a reason. They just said in their like nice corporate way, like, no. And you know, so that person has been like stalking my Instagram. There's been countless other people right now, and it's making me think, okay, yo, what should I do? Should I block these people so that they can't have that privilege of like viewing my Instagram? Or should I honestly don't know what to do right now. I feel like they don't deserve my energy right now. And if they're going to if they want to contact me, they got I have an email. But as for like my, you know, my Instagram, my personal Instagram and doing X, Y, and Z, like I feel like they shouldn't have access to my space that I congregate with other people of like-minded. Some people not like-minded, but mostly like-minded individuals that like build me up and like they heal me. So I don't want that negative energy in my space. So I think I just answered my own question. I'll be blocking them.
Yeah, like plain and simple. You know, it's just
y'all. I just want to say this, just in case my phone is about to.
Oh. Yeah. Well. Okay. Well, in that case, No, it's okay. No. That just means that just means y'all are gonna have to come back on, and we're gonna have to continue this conversation at some point. But it's okay. No, it's okay. It's fine. I feel like we could have talked for like much longer, but you know what? We got things to do. I'm going to the rally in the next hour. So, and I know Cameron is about to go watch Black is King. So like we got things to do, and we got to continue to like live our lives. Okay. We can come back in another week and continue this. Okay. I appreciate y'all coming on though and discussing all this with me. I know it was kind of all over the place, but I really think it was do y'all feel better? Cause I feel better.
I feel great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am so grateful that I was able to have this conversation in this moment with you two people specifically.
Damn.
And it's just good to see us smiling and like being able to engage without it bringing us down.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Well, before we go, just give y'all handles so that people can follow you. I know that Cameron's not on Instagram, but you know, if you have like a website or something that people want to like follow you on, let them know.
Yeah. No, I'm not on Instagram right now. I'll be back on Instagram. Well, I'm writing a one-man show, and it might be doing some things in New Orleans. It might not. I won't know until later. Mm-hmm. But when it is back up, it's at The Genius Negus.
Yes.
At The Genius Negus. And I've been gathering a lot of stuff for my website. There's so many different branches by my birthday, by January. So by age 30, I will have a website, 30 on 30.
Hey. yeah, people can follow No Dream Deferred NOLA on Insta and Facebook at NDD NOLA. Our website is www.nodreamdeferrednola.com. And yeah, so, and I would say that our social is very personalized to me and India's aesthetics.
Ooh, I love it. I love it. I love it. It is a space for us, by us.
Yes.
Well, you guys, thank y'all so much for tuning in. If you have any suggestions for future things you'd like us to cover or me to cover on the Self-Aware Millennial, please DM me at the Self-Aware Millennial on Instagram, or you can email the selfawaremillennial@gmail.com. You can also check out the link tree on either my personal Instagram or the Self-Aware Millennial. And if you're all caught up, consider joining T-San's Patreon, where I talk more about all of this stuff. I've actually already kind of given a go around of like the things that I've talked about in the living doc. So go there. There's other bonus clips, bonus information, bonus all over the place that I definitely feel more comfortable in the T-San community expressing than I do necessarily on here. So again, and if I actually, what I will do at the end of this episode, I will post like another, like, I don't know, 3 to 5 minute clip so that y'all can hear just a little piece about what I've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, y'all, thank y'all so much again. And I should also mention right quick, next week I will be joined by Queen Amor. If y'all don't know who, we were literally talking about her on the last episode Ariana Amor. But Queen Amor is revolutionary trans woman here in New Orleans that has been the one like twerking on the cop cars and just basically making herself known. And I'm really excited to have her on this episode next week. So please tune in. And again, y'all, thank y'all so much. And I hope y'all have a great day. Bye. I should also say this friend of mine was wanting me to sing and I told him, yo, I have tonsillitis. I really should not be singing right now. I was able to sing, but I just didn't want to chance it. I was still on antibiotics and I just, yeah. So, I mean, I ended up singing once. I did end up singing a song and it was a Victory Bell-esque song. I should also mention, this is something I forgot to like mention to other folks that I've been telling this to. They definitely love the Victory Bells. Like, white people love the Victory Bells. So I know that this friend of mine's tactic was to tell others, the whole room of people, white people, was that I was a Victory Bell. Because then they would, you know, the ears would perk up and they'd be like, why is this black woman here? And now they're like, oh, she's a Victory Bell. Almost like I have a pass because I am one. And because I, you know, the Victory Bells are very patriotic. And white people, especially, you know, the Trump supporters, they love their patriotism. So anyway, the fourth strike that happened to me was the same friend of mine touched my braids without permission. Now, I am in a new place and I was very close to letting him know, please don't touch my hair. But I didn't do it, which means that I'm not completely there yet in my demands, but I'm getting there. I saw myself saying stop it and I just didn't do it. So, and I think it's just, I don't know why, I don't know what it is about. I mean, yes, these braids are cute, but they don't need to be touched. You can acknowledge them without touching them, you know, like I'm not a show and tell object. I don't need to be touched. So this is my fifth strike, y'all. Now this is the one that really set me over the edge, and this was like, this is when I started to think that this was all a dream. At the end of the program, if you want to call it a program, or of his set where he like closed things out, this was all after I finished like eating my appetizers, entree, and dessert, by the way. He wanted me to sing another song and I was just like, I'm good. I really don't want to sing another one. But, you know, he was like, well, I have you here and I just really want you to sing da 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 da. And I was just like, At that point, I was going to sing another song and I had one in mind. It was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. But then another woman had sang it right before me. So I was like, I'm not going to sing that. So I was like, forget it. That just means there's a sign. I should not be singing again. And he decided to just have me come up there with him. And he was going to pick the song. Well, guess what song he picked? He picked God Bless America, y'all. He picked God Bless America. And I was like, I know you're lying. Like, I get the whole Victory Bell reference, but with everything going on, and I know he knows my thoughts on being patriotic at this point. But that audience, oh my gosh, like, it was one of those token situations that I knew I was like, I was singing this song. I wasn't even singing it. Like, he sang most of it. I held that microphone, like, far the way out. And I just kept, I was looking into a gate. Someone filmed it, too. There was another, I think it was a lady who was, I think she might be, like, one of the managers of this restaurant. But she filmed it. And she was, like, right in my face, too. And I was like, I wonder where this video went. Because I really want to see it just so that I can look at my face to see how ridiculous it was when I was like actually trying to sing this song with these white people. They all stood up and they all just, I was absolutely done at that point.